Well, I wonder if you find life confusing. How is it that, on the one hand, humanity can prove itself so ingenious, so brilliant at solving problems, so able to make progress in all manner of different areas, and yet, on the other, display a callous disregard for the plight of those in need, promoting injustice and inequality, and be personally vindictive or violent? How can one thing, like the internet, be such a force for good on the one hand, and such a force for ill and damage on the other? Take today's paper. In this section, there's an article about some medical advances. There's then a whole section devoted to our technological progress and the way in which that helps our lives. It then moves on to the arts and culture. There's theatre, there's film, there's music, there's art, and there's TV. It's a terrific picture and representation of so much that is good and creative and innovative about humanity. But then there's this bit. On the front page, a story about rape. Inside, accounts of right-wing extremism. An article looking back to the slave trade. Stories of murder committed by a teenager. The need for police. The effect of industrial pollution. And of course, stories about climate change as well. That's the world we live in, isn't it? Both things seem to go hand in hand. And maybe the Robert Louis Stevenson's story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde just encapsulates it for us. In one person, there can be kindness and thoughtfulness alongside cruelty and vengeance. The world can be a very confusing place. And that's the world that we encounter as we open up Genesis chapter 4. We left the story before Christmas at the end of chapter 3. Adam and Eve had rejected what they'd been created for, that is, a personal, face-to-face relationship with their Creator. And they rejected the place in which that relationship was to take place and had been driven out of the garden. And they'd been cast out because of their rebellion against God, their refusal to live according to God's words. So what is life outside of the garden going to be like? How are they going to cope separated from their Creator? Hopefully you've got sight of a note sheet. Don't turn to the back of Church Family News, because those are the notes in this morning's talk. You might try and use them, but they won't be terribly helpful. If you'd like a sheet for tonight and didn't pick one up, wave a paw in the air, and somebody will go and get you one from the back. Otherwise, if you're all happy, that's fine. We'll progress then. First heading then, humanity experiencing God's judgment. That's verses 1 to 7 of chapter 4. Humanity experiencing God's judgment. And at first glance, things seem to be going on just fine, don't they? If you just turn back a page to verse 28 of chapter 1, Adam and Eve were commanded, as part of God's blessing, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heavens and over every living creature that moves on the earth. And so we read, Cain and Abel are born. The multiplying is going well. We read too that the animals are being looked after. Abel is a keeper of sheep. And the ground's being looked after. Cain is a worker of the ground. So everything's progressing as it should do, isn't it? And then if you look at verse 3, they're even looking to their Creator. They're coming to their Creator to make an offering. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. Now, we're not told why they did this. We're not told what they were expecting when they did it, nor are we told anything about their motivation for doing it. But they do it. And Moses tells us, middle of verse 4, the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. Now, we're not told how they knew that, but that's what we're told. We're not told why the Lord makes this choice. Some people have suggested that, of course, if it's animals, it's about sacrifice, and sacrifice is better than offering. But the sacrifice word is not here. Both are described as offering. They are equal in that regard. Certainly later in the Old Testament, firstborn and fat portions are regarded as the very choicest bits. So some want to say, Abel gave of the choicest stuff, Cain just bought any old thing. But again, that's not what the account tells us. It doesn't focus on that at all. What you will notice, though, if you look, is that the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering. So it looks as though the person is more important than the offering. So the heart status of Abel and the heart status of Cain are actually what matter. The offering is secondary. And that's certainly what the New Testament says. Let's have the first slide up, please. Excellent. In Matthew, Jesus says this, so that you may come, so that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of innocent Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Barachai. In other words, Jesus is telling us, in many ways, that Abel was one of the first ones killed for being righteous, that is, right with God. Hebrews 4, the author there says, by faith Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous. God commended him by accepting his gifts, and through his faith, though he died, he still speaks. His own deeds were evil, and his brother's righteous. Clear again, isn't it? Abel was a man of faith. Abel was a man who was right before God. And 1 John, we read this, we shouldn't be like Cain, who was the evil one and murdered his brother. Why did he murder him? Because his own deeds were evil and his brother's righteous. Thanks, Alex. You can take that away for a moment. So it would appear that God knew Abel and knew Abel's standing before him, and therefore accepted his offering. But we just need to remember, don't we, that throughout the Bible, it is God who chooses. And often, as the Bible talks about God's choosing, it gives no reason why. Because he is the sovereign Lord, therefore he may choose. Notice how God is kind to Cain in the light of this. The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry, and why has your face fallen? But all is not lost. If you do well, will you not be accepted? All is not lost for Cain yet. He has responded in anger, very angry, which may well suggest that the Lord's decision was absolutely right. But Cain must be in no doubt as to the power of sin that is preying upon him. If you do well, will you not be accepted? Verse 7. If you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. It's a very dramatic picture, isn't it? The wild beast waiting to pounce, to tear its prey apart and to eat it up. That is the threat of sin that is facing Cain. Interestingly, if you just glance across the column, you will notice in verse 16, right at the top of that next column, this is exactly the same vocabulary that was used as God warned Eve about wanting to rule over Adam. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. So let's make sure that we are not fooled by the orderliness of life. Just because things appear to be going on as they have always gone on, just because it appears that life is working, don't think that we are not still under God's judgment. Don't think the threat has in any way disappeared or been removed. The Lord has not forgotten the word of judgment he has spoken. And equally, let's not assume that God will be satisfied with just anything we choose to offer him or anything we choose to do. We can think about that in very sort of simple human terms, can't we? We'll have refreshments later. Somebody runs up to you and offers you a cup of milky tea with three sugars in it. I can't imagine anybody here drinks milky tea with three sugars in it, but I could be wrong. If you offered me milky tea with three sugars in it, I wouldn't be particularly pleased at all. It wouldn't be an acceptable offering. And that rather trivial way just gives us a bit of a pointer to how things are with God. He has spoken of what is an acceptable offering. We know that it's the need for us to give him all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, all of our lives. So nothing else will do. Let's not pretend that an hour a week or whatever it is will actually suffice. Acceptable offerings are the ones that he has spoken about. But the Bible is also quite clear that even if we do what appears to be the right thing according to what God has spoken, sinful hearts, wrongly motivated hearts, can deny the benefit of the offering just as effectively. And finally, let's not assume we are stronger than sin. To underestimate the power of sin, to forget that it is waiting for us to tear us apart and to devour us, will see us fail time and time again. This warning invites us all to recognize our weakness before sin. First of all, then, humanity experiencing God's judgment. Secondly, humanity powerless before sin. That's verses 8 to 16. And as the narrative continues, that power, that weakness before sin is cruelly exposed. Cain spoke to Abel, his brother, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. The act is premeditated. If you look down to the footnote you've got at the bottom of the page there, that has a slightly different reading of that verse. I don't think we need that. We get that sense. The word spoken is the one that gets them into the field together. The implication is there without the footnote, but it just drives the point home if you need that. What Cain does to his brother, he rose up against him and killed him. That's used of violence perpetrated by one individual upon another. It's that sort of killing. Now, what we're meant to do as we read chapter 4 is to have chapter 3 in our minds. Back in chapter 3, you'll remember that the serpent had to persuade Eve that the fruit was worth eating. Here, despite the warning he's received, Cain conceives and completes the act himself, doesn't he? Let's have the next slide up, Alex, please, because there are some other parallels it's worth noting. The language that the Lord uses in chapter 4 echoes that in chapter 3. Verse 9, the Lord says to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" Verse 9 of chapter 3, the Lord called to the man and said to him, "Where are you?" Verse 10 of chapter 4, the Lord said to Cain, "What have you done?" Verse 13 of chapter 3, the Lord said to the woman, "What is it that you have done?" The language is deliberately echoing what has gone before. So we just understand that this development of sin, this expression of sin, that starting point for sin, is growing, both in intensity and in seriousness. Like his mother and father, Cain refuses to take responsibility for what he's done. He says, verse 9, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" There's probably a bit of a play on words there. He possibly says, "Am I the shepherd's shepherd?" Well, of course, you can't be anyone's keeper, but you are his brother. And you'll just notice how often the brother word crops up in the text. That sense of responsibility and relationship should count for something. Once again, the Lord pronounces judgment. Verse 10, the Lord said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground, and now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hands." You'll notice in verse 17 of chapter 3, Adam isn't cursed, but the ground is cursed because of what Adam has done in listening to Eve. Now, the ground, if you like, cries out for Cain to be cursed. And that is what happens. So rather than the ground being cursed because of the sin, Cain is cursed because of the sin. Previously, Adam was told that working the ground would now be a matter of sweat and tears. Notice verse 12, things get worse for Cain. "When you work the ground," and don't forget he's an arable farmer, "when you work the ground, it shall no longer yield to you its strength." In chapter 3, the picture was it would yield to you its strength, it would just be a lot of effort to get anything out of it. It's getting worse. The judgment is more severe. So maybe it's no surprise that later in the account we read that Cain now founds a city. He leaves the farmland and founds a city. You'll notice too that Cain is driven further from the garden. Adam and Eve at the end of chapter 3, verse 24, the Lord drove out the man. So they were driven out of the Garden of Eden. But notice here how Cain is driven further away. Verse 14. "Behold, you have driven me today away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden." So it's a distance thing, it's a geography thing, but most of all, it's away from the presence of the Lord. That is the key element in this punishment. Further away from Eden, further away from the presence of God, further away from God himself. Now, Adam and Eve, you'll remember, they tried to blame each other and blame the serpent, didn't they? Well, Cain does similarly, but although they do that, Adam and Eve accept their punishment. They don't come back at God about the punishment. Have a look at verse 13. Cain says to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me away. I shall be a fugitive and wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." Once again, God in his kindness and mercy looks with favor on Cain. Verse 15, the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attack him. Now, I don't know about you, but if you've been asked before this evening what the mark of Cain was, I think most of us would have thought it was a pretty bad thing because of various horror movies and books and all the rest of it. But actually, notice here, the mark of Cain is God's generosity. It's God's kindness. It's God's protection on Cain. It's to keep him safe from being killed. And again, there's a parallel with the way in which the Lord clothes Adam and Eve in verse 21 of chapter 3. The Lord provides protection even for those who have rejected him. Sin is a terrible thing. Sin stains everything. Sin spreads to every part of life. And sin separates people from God, people from one another, brother from brother, even to the extent of murder. That's what life outside the garden is all about. This then is the human condition. This is our condition. And Cain's powerlessness to resist the lure and temptation of sin is ours as well. And just as he was subject to the results of giving to that temptation, so are we. Continue to experience God's judgment because of it. Humanity, we are powerless before sin. Thanks, Alex. You can take that away for the moment. So then we come to verses 17 to 24. And here we find humanity searching for a better life. And essentially what happens in verse 17 is that we return to the genealogy that we left at verse 2. The story of Cain and Abel just interrupts the genealogy. And you'll notice what we see emphasized here once again is that the creation mandate to be fruitful and multiply, the creation mandate to have dominion and subdue the earth, is what is going on. And human existence as we know it begins to get a bit more recognizable, doesn't it? A city is built, children are born. What else do we discover? Well, just look on to verse 20. Jabal was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. Some says that's the start of the scouting movement, but I don't quite believe that myself. Then there's Jubal, who was the father of those who play the lyre and pipe. There's music. There's Tubal-Cain. He was a forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. So we've got technology starting. We've got metalworking. We've got musical instruments. They've therefore got music. And in verse 23, we've got poetry as well. Life is beginning to become quite recognizable. But with this guy Lamech, we notice a couple of things. There are a couple of things that don't quite ring true, aren't there? Do you notice those? Have a look at verse 19. How does verse 19 open? And Lamech took two wives. Whereas back at the end of chapter 2, the marriage relationship is between one man and one woman, an exclusive, lifelong relationship. Lamech thinks he can do better. Mankind has continued to think it can improve on God's gift of marriage, as taught in the Bible. And then he takes this gift of poetry, and what does he do with it in verses 23 and 24? Adah and Zillah, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77 fold. The poetry becomes a celebration of vengeance and violence. But just to temper things a little bit, the phrase young man at the end of verse 23 can be anyone under 40, which would be a comfort to some of us here this evening. I appreciate that. So you see, sin spreads. The violence of Cain is now taken to another level entirely and becomes a badge of honor for Lamech, something he's all too keen to boast about. And this is our world, isn't it? Technological advance, creativity, inventiveness. But there is always the threat of sin in the background, isn't there? If poetry can be used to celebrate such bloodshed, to what end might the metals be put in time? And we've got nothing to be particularly proud about in our own day or our recent history, have we? It's said that the 20th century saw more people die in war than all the preceding centuries put together. On the news daily, we hear of the latest victims of knife crime, dying often because of some perceived slight on social media. Now, we might not be murderers in that sense or on that scale. Let's have the next slide up, Alex, please. But as Jesus tells us, we do hate. We are angry. Jesus said, "But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says, 'You fool,' will be liable to the hell of fire." For us, those murderous thoughts when somebody cuts us up on the road, that annoyance when we get another phone call telling me that my internet is about to go down and I must do something about it, whatever that particular thing is, those thoughts reveal the status of our hearts. Those are the murderous thoughts that Jesus talks about. Some have seen here what we might call the pride of self-sufficiency. Mankind doing their own thing, celebrating being apart from God, rejoicing in the fact that they don't actually need him for life to work and to be successful, coming together to build cities, trying, dare we say, to recreate Eden by themselves. That will reach a climax when we get to chapter 11 in a few weeks' time. And of course, that has been a pattern of what has happened throughout history. I'm sure a number of us read Lord of the Flies at school. That sort of opportunity to create a great society. The search for utopia has been something that has driven many in our world and in recent days to make life better. Oops, what happened there? That's where I want to go. I'm sure we all have earworms. And whenever I hear the word garden, this is the earworm that always gets me. This is the chorus from a great, great Joni Mitchell song. We are stardust, we are golden, and we've got to get ourselves back to the garden. Anyone give me a date for that? Which event was it associated with? Which great musical event occasion was it associated with? Woodstock, absolutely right. The hope was that that group at that time could create a new society. But of course, Woodstock failed, just as the guys in Lord of the Flies failed, just as all such attempts through history have failed. Because no one has resolved the problem of human sinfulness. Because of that, we are incapable of creating, recreating, returning to the garden for ourselves. Only the Creator can do that. Let's have that taken away for a moment, Alex. Thank you. Finally, then, hope is to be found in God alone, verses 25 and 26. After the Lamech digression, we come back to the genealogy. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth, for she said, God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him. The first sign of hope is this birth. In verse 15 of chapter 3, the Lord said to Eve, I will put enmity between, to the serpent, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. In other words, there would be a descendant of Adam and Eve who would one day triumph over evil rather than suffer under evil. And the choice of the word offspring, seed, here is significant. Well, is it Seth or is it someone from the line of Seth? That's the question. The second sign of hope is there in verse 26. At that time, people began to call on the name of the Lord. And the language of call upon is used later in the Old Testament when describing the corporate worship of Israel, particularly in the wilderness around the tabernacle. And there may be something here of the need for a corporate response and a growing corporate response from the created beings towards their Creator. But that sense of calling upon the name of the Lord is one that we see growing as Scripture moves on. It's there in the prophets. All who call on the name of the Lord will be saved. It's there in Acts chapter 2 as Peter preaches the gospel for the first time. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. And so it's in this Lord who gives us the invitation to call upon him, where we find hope. Hope in a confused and confusing world. Hope for sinful humanity. Hope of a return to the presence of the Lord. Of a return to the garden. Let's have the final slide up, Alex, please. Because in Hebrews 12, read these words. We come to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Abel's blood cried out for justice. Jesus' blood cries out for mercy on sinful humanity. And that mercy is available to sinful humanity through the death of Jesus and through the gospel. So our hope lies in a God who will respond to our call. Hope lies in the fact that his invitation to us to call upon him is founded on the death of the Lord Jesus. The promise of sins forgiven. The promise of eternity with our Creator. Not going back to the garden, but going to an even better place with him. All founded on the shed blood of Jesus, the blood that speaks a better word, a word of mercy.